In the biography of Henry Ford, there is a very interesting story about a very strange object that was found in his workshop upon his death. I'm certain that each of us has had the experience, if you haven't, you will have it, of having a death in the family, and after the family leaves the funeral in the next few days, loved ones will gather at the home, go into the room, and begin to take care of the remaining effects of the deceased. And after Henry Ford's death, when those who were charged with that responsibility went into his laboratory, his workshop, and began to go through the objects that were there, they found a test tube. And in that test tube was a cork. And on that test tube was a label. And on that label was written Thomas Edison's last breath. Now, those who knew Henry Ford knew why Henry had that test tube with the label containing the mythical last breath of Thomas Edison. And it was because when Henry Ford began to work on the development of the idea of the combustion engine and the automobile, he had any number of people who approached him and said, "Henry, you dreamer. Henry, you are an idiot. Henry, you are a fool. Henry, why are you always dabbling in these wild ideas? Why can't you do something practical like being an accountant or an architect?" Henry had plenty of discouragers. But one day, Henry Ford went to a banquet where Thomas Edison was the speaker. We all know who Thomas Edison was, an inventive genius. We don't know exactly how it happened, and the story does not relate how it came to pass. But somehow during the evening, Henry Ford started talking to Thomas Edison. He may have explained to him his concept for the internal combustion engine and the automobile. He may have, as sometimes happens, taken one of the banquet napkins and stretched it out over the table and got his pencil and started scribbling his ideas on the napkin. But whatever he did before the evening was over, Thomas Edison turned to Henry Ford and said, "Henry, I think it'll work. Why don't you go out and build it?" And you and I know the history, don't we? The history is on the parking lot. How many of us have automobiles bearing Henry's name or built by the company bearing his name? As I read the passage that Brother Ken read for us just a moment ago, I'm made to wonder if those who went into the final abode of Paul to go through his meager belongings following his death found a test tube with a cork in it, with a label upon it, that said, "The last breath of Barnabas." When we read Acts chapter 9, we discover how frighteningly close the church came to losing Paul as a great apostle and a great preacher. Because though he tried, though he did everything he could do, there were those in the church who would not let the apostle Paul forget what he had been. There were those in the church who would not let the apostle Paul forget that he had been a persecutor, that he had been a destroyer of the church. And when Paul came to them and tried to preach the gospel and tried to associate himself with them, they said to him, "Paul, we'll have no part of you. Paul, why don't you just go on about your business somewhere else? We know what you were. We know what you did. We don't want to have anything to do with you. Just get out." And it was at that point that Barnabas, the son of encouragement, put his arms around the apostle Paul and took him to the church and said to the church, "I know this man. I trust this man. I love this man. He is a preacher of the gospel. Let us use him to the glory of God." And you and I know the history. Is it any wonder that when the Apostle Paul wrote his many epistles, that one of the major themes that Paul carried throughout was the encouragement of the brethren? And I just wonder if as Paul sat down and wrote Romans and 1st and 2nd Corinthians and Galatians and Ephesians and Philippians and Colossians and 1st and 2nd Thessalonians and on, I wonder if his mind didn't go back to those days recorded in Acts chapter 9. And though he never used the language, I wonder if when he said, "Love one another, encourage one another," he wasn't in essence saying to those brethren in the Lord, "You treat one another like Barnabas treated me." For example, in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, and beginning in verse 11, Paul writes, "Therefore, encourage one another and build up one another, just as you are also doing. But we request of you, brethren, that you appreciate those who diligently labor among you and have charge over you in the Lord and give you instruction, that you esteem them very highly in love because of their work. Live in peace with one another. And we urge you, brethren," listen to it, "admonish the unruly, encourage the faint-hearted, help the weak, be patient with all men." Can't you see in the mind of Paul his memory of Barnabas? In those words, Paul over and over impresses upon us the great truth that the path of faith includes giving ourselves to Jesus Christ. But let us never forget that Paul also over and over impresses upon us that the path of faith includes giving ourselves to one another in Jesus Christ. Where do we begin? Giving ourselves to one another, helping others, begins where Paul began with Barnabas, by encouraging and building one another up. Did you ever notice, reading through the life of Jesus Christ, how Jesus Christ always looked for the very best in people? For example, Jesus walked down the street one day and he saw a man named Matthew. And when he saw Matthew, what did everybody see in Matthew? Matthew the publican, Matthew the tax collector, Matthew the hated one. But what did Jesus see? Jesus saw a disciple. Jesus saw one who had the potential to become an apostle. And to that man who was hated, he said, "Come and follow me." When Jesus went into the city of Jericho, he saw a man that even our young children know about. The wee little man named Zacchaeus who went up into the sycamore tree, the Lord he wanted to see. And when the Lord came walking by, he looked up in that tree and he said, "Oops, can't associate with that one. He's hated and despised. He has mistreated people. He has taken that which is not his own and which is not rightfully due him. And if I associate with him, people will think ill of me. I can't have anything to do with him." No. Jesus risked the enmity of the entire town. Because he saw in Zacchaeus a son of Abraham. And he wanted to say to him, "You may have forgotten it. You may have gotten away from your heritage, but you are a child of Abraham and you are important. Now you come down out of that tree because I'm going to your house today and I'm going to dine with you." Jesus always looked for the best in people. As a matter of fact, as you look through and read the biography of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, you will discover that the harshest words that Jesus ever spoke were reserved for those super critical discouragers of men. Those people who were so preoccupied with the splinters in the eyes of others that they could not see 2x4s in their own. Jesus mocked such people. Jesus held them up to ridicule. And you and I know what he was talking about, don't we? Because we are familiar with discouragers of men. Maybe some of us had parents who were guilty of it. Maybe some of us are parents who are guilty of it. Children sometimes say, "Well, you know, I go to school and I work as hard as I can at my classes and at my grades. And I bring home a report card and it's got nearly all A's on it, but it's got this B. And that's the only thing in this world my folks can see. And that's all I hear about." Or a young lady's trying to learn to cook, and she works hard, and she comes in, and she puts a beautiful meal on the table, except there are lumps in the mashed potatoes. And that's all anybody can talk about, is the lumps in the mashed potatoes. Or little Johnny goes out to cut the yard. And Daddy comes out to inspect. "Not, Johnny, you did a good job,
Not Johnny, you got 99% of it right. Not Johnny, I'm proud of you for the work you did. Johnny, you missed that spot there by the garbage can. And that's all we can see. And so we break. Well, that can't be too important. Those are just kids. I work hard all day at home trying to make a home for my family. And I do the best I can when the husband comes in the evening. He doesn't see the clean sheets. He doesn't see the good food on the table. He sees a little dust on the bookcase, and that's all he can talk about. Sound familiar to anybody? Oh, it's getting sort of practical, isn't it? I go off to work and I work as hard as I can at the job I have, the very best that I can get. And I come home in the evenings and there is not a word of thanks for what you do to provide for me and the kids. It's, why can't we have what the Joneses down the street have? We know about the discouragers of men, do we not? Now let's be kind. And let's assume that these comments and others of like nature were not intended to hurt. But whether they are intended to hurt or not, they do hurt, don't they? And they are the very worst kind of sin that can be committed against a person, because they are a sin against the Spirit. Our success in life. And when I talk about success in life, I'm not just talking about success in school. I'm not talking about success as a husband and a wife. I'm talking about even our success as a child of God in living the Christian life depends in large part on our concept that we have of ourselves and the concept of us that others have as well. Whether we think we can do it and whether others think we can do it. I don't know how many school teachers. I know we've got a number. I'm sure I don't know all of our school teachers here at Fleetwood. But school teachers, isn't it true that if little Johnny gets a bad reputation in the second grade and it precedes him from teacher to teacher to teacher, by the time he gets to the 12th grade, if he gets that far without dropping out, little Johnny's going to be doing the very best that he can to be the kind of boy that everybody says he is. Why do we wonder why Christians can't live as we ought to live when everybody's telling us we can't do it? And not giving us any encouragement to live the kind of life that we can live in Jesus Christ. But that kind of discourager of man not only hurts others, he hurts himself. Because that person who has the jaundiced eye, that person who is always trying to be the district attorney, as it were, is miserable himself or herself. Can you imagine what kind of joy in life a person has who walks into a beautiful room of thriving plants and can't see anything but one yellow leaf? Can you imagine how miserable a person has to be who is looking at the lives of other people and can never see the good and the beautiful that is in their lives, but can only see the little thing they did, or maybe even the big thing that was wrong?
It's sort of depressing to be around people like that, isn't it? Let me ask you. When you want to have coffee with somebody, is that the kind of person you pick to have coffee with? You have a person like that next door. You'll drive 10 miles to have coffee instead of going next door. Because it is not good for the spirit. And that is the reason that the command of Jesus Christ by inspiration is and has always been, be ye kind one to another, tender hearted, forgiving one another, even as God also for Christ's sake hath forgiven you, Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 32. I want you to look around you this morning. To your left, to your right, in front, behind. And I want you to see the people who are struggling, who are having difficulties perhaps we know nothing of. Look around you this morning. Oh, I'm looking. I don't see. No, you're not really looking. Oh, yeah, I'm looking. Well, if you're looking that way, you're not listening. Don't look at faces. Look at people. Look around you this morning. See who is not here. Have you ever wondered why they're not here? Have you ever wondered what kind of struggle prevents them from coming to worship? And have you ever gone to them with a word of encouragement and hope? Lord, give me eyes lest I, as people will, should pass by somebody else's Calvary and call it just a hill. A number of years ago, there was a golf fan. You're probably saying, well, I knew he'd get around to a golf story before this was over. There was a golf fan who had an opportunity to go to the Masters golf tournament at Augusta National in Georgia. Now, the golf fans here know what that means. You don't just walk up to the Augusta National ticket office and say, give me a ticket to the Masters today. They're sold out for years. You might be able to get one from a scalper, but you'll pay dearly for it. But this man had a friend who said, here is a ticket. Would you like to go? Well, anybody, especially a golf fan, would love to go. Now, this golfer was an older golfer. And so he found himself that day in that portion of the gallery that is known as Arnie's Army. The folks who follow Arnold Palmer. Arnold didn't have a ghost of a prayer of a chance of winning the Masters. But that's all right. Arnie's my man. I'll go with him. And on one hole, Arnold Palmer jerked a shot, and it went off down yonder by the creek. And this fan, wanting to show how erudite he was and how knowledgeable in golf, turned to the man to his right, said, Arnie's in real trouble. His shot went right down there by the creek. And to get it out from the creek, Arnie's got to hit it with a 2-iron. And he's got to hit it hard. But if Arnie hits it hard, it's going to go all the way across the fairway, and it's going to go out of bounds. And that's a 2-shot penalty.
Arnie is in a bind. And he said the man to whom he gave that fine commentary turned to him and said, "Mister, is this your first master's?" He looked at him and said, "Yes." Wondered how he knew. He said, "Arnie's going to hit that ball. He's going to hit it hard with a 2-iron. And he's going to hit it right straight toward the crowd." The man said, Arnold stepped up. He got his 2-iron. He lined up. And he hit that ball with a mighty lick. And sure enough, it flew all the way across the fairway and into that crowd. But the would-be commentator said, "You know, by the time that crowd had finished pushing and pulling and kicking that ball, it was right back out in the fairway." And he said, the man to whom he had spoken turned to him and said, "Mister, as long as there is a gallery at the Masters, Arnold Palmer will never go out of bounds." Good folks, somewhere there is a life that is about to go out of bounds. And would to God, it could be said, as long as there are New Testament Christians, as long as there is a Fleetwood, none of those folks will ever go out of bounds. Where's your life this morning? Are you an encourager or a discourager of people? If you're going to be an encourager of people, you've got to be a Christian. And if you're here this morning and you're not a Christian, that's the beginning place. Come. We're going to stand and sing the invitation hymn in a minute, and you need to come. Come up here, give me your hand, give God your heart as we sing. Confess your faith in Jesus Christ, having repented of sins, be buried in the waters of baptism, and arise to walk in newness of life, and go to be an encourager and a lifter up of people. If you've wandered away from the Lord, this is your opportunity to return, to say once more, "I love you, and I want to walk with you to the end." If you're subject to His invitation, this opportunity is yours. Would you come while we stand and while we sing?